Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we are live from 2 to 3 in the afternoon Pacific Daylight Time as usual. And you can call in and be on the program today if you're listening to the live broadcast. If you have something to ask about Christian related topics, if you have a question about the Bible or about Christianity, about the history of Christianity, about the apologetics, evidences of Christianity, or simply a solution to a difficult passage in the Bible, or perhaps two passages that appear to be in contradiction to each other. Anything that you have questions or problems with that you want to ask about, you can ask about here. And in saying that, I want to clarify that I'm not claiming that I have the answer to every difficulty. I'm only saying that if you have difficulties, you can bring them up here. Perhaps we can answer them. And if I cannot, perhaps somebody else can. That is, someone who can call in and help us out. And when it comes to that point, if you are one of those people who feels that an answer has been given that is wrong to a previous question, feel free to give me a call. Now, I'm not asking you to just give, call and give a sermon on a subject. I'm asking you to call and disagree with the host on something if you feel there's something that the host has said that needs to be corrected. So you can present a difference of opinion, and you can present it and defend it. You're welcome to do that here, and you'll, there'll be no problem with that. But I don't particularly, you know, I'm not talking about just calling up to give a little sermonette of your own on some subject. All right, we're going to go to the phones, but let me give you the phone number. If you want to be on the program today, the number is 1-800-438-5090. That is 1-800-438-5090. If you'd like to be on the program today, we have a line or two open right now for you. Our first caller today is Bob from Portland, Oregon. Hi, Bob.
Hello, Steve.
Hi, you got a question for me today?
Yes. I was talking to you about in the third chapter of Revelation the other day about the beginning of the creation of God.
Yes.
Jesus talking. Well, I do believe that, of course, he is the great creator, Jesus is. He said, through whom he made the heavens and the earth, God did in Hebrews 1. And also in Hebrews 7, he's referring to Melchizedek. He said, which is King of Righteousness, and then also King of Salem, that is peace, which is King of Peace, without father, without mother, without genealogy, having neither beginning of days nor end of life, but made unto the, like unto the Son of God, abides a priest continually. Now, Jesus had neither beginning of days nor end of life.
Right. So what's your question, Bob?
That indicates he's not a created one, but he is one of the Godhead, the Father, the Son, and the Holy Spirit. I think he's a part of the Trinity, and he is also from the beginning, having neither beginning of days nor end of life. So I was wrong about
so,
that.
Oh, I see. I got you. So you're just correcting yourself from yesterday?
I'm just correcting myself. Yeah, like it says in the first verse of Genesis, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, and that's Jesus. And and then also Isaiah 9:6, where it's referring to the Son of God, for unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given, and the government shall be upon his shoulder, and his name shall be called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace.
Right, and so obviously these verses do teach that Jesus is God. Exactly in what sense he is God, obviously, is confusing to us because there's only one God, and yet there's, as the Trinitarian doctrine says, there's three persons in God. and how those three are one has been discussed by theologians for a very long time without reaching a total consensus among those who study the matter. But, yeah, you're right. Jesus, I think it's correct. He's not a created being. He is the one through whom all created things have been created. And John's Gospel and many other, and Colossians 1 and Hebrews 1 tell us those things. Bob, I appreciate you calling to correct that. Good talking to you too, brother.
Bye.
Bye now.
God bless.
Thanks. Oh, I'm sorry. Cut off the end of his sentence there. I just wanted to say that we have lines open for you right now. If you'd like to call 1-800-438-5090. You're listening to The Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and I'll be glad to talk to you when you give us a call. I also want you to know that we have a meeting coming up tomorrow night. It only happens once a month. It's in Salinas, California. So if you live in the KKMC listening area, you are generally within range of that meeting. We have people who drive, I think an hour and a half or so to get there each time we meet. And so it's hard to decide what that area includes, what that area does not. But if you'd like to come and join a group of people who listen to this program, and some of them are callers, into the program, we meet in a home once a month in Salinas, and we just have an open Bible discussion, very much like this program, with whoever shows up. And you can join us for a little while or for the whole evening if you want to. It's very casual. It starts at 7 o'clock. It's in a home in Salinas. If you already have been to that before, you know where it is. If you've never been there before, let me give you a phone number. You can call for directions. The number to call for that meeting tomorrow night in Salinas is area code 831-783-1445. That's area code 831-783-1445 if you'd like to join us tomorrow night at 7 for our gathering in Salinas, which occurs only once a month in that location. All right, we're going to go next to another call, which is from Juan, calling from Monterey, California. Juan, welcome to The Narrow Path. Uh-oh, looks like Juan's, I don't know, what happened there? Sounds like Juan didn't remain with us, so maybe he'll call back. We seem to have gotten cut off there. I have received several questions by email in the last few days. I will take one of those at this time, and if you want to call me on the air, the number is 1-800-438-5090. Mike emailed me, I think it was yesterday. He said, hi, I have a question on the 390 days / 390 years punishment for the sins of the house of Israel and the 40 days / 40 years punishment of the house of Judah in Ezekiel chapter 4, verses 4 through 6. And he says, do you add 390 to 592 B.C., which he says is 982 B.C.? Of course, that'd be subtracting those from that. He says, wasn't David king at this time? He says, I see 40 years added to 592 B.C., which is 632 B.C., which would be the time of King Josiah. What sins is Ezekiel talking about? Well, Mike, it sounds like you're really kind of confused about this, because by adding numbers to a certain year B.C., you end up with a smaller year in the end. You've added, you're assuming a starting date of 592 B.C. You don't say where you're getting that date, but I assume that's the date you're assuming that Ezekiel wrote this. Okay, so if Ezekiel wrote this in 592 B.C., you added 390 years to that, and you came up with 982 B.C. Actually, no, it'd go the other direction. When you add years to 592 B.C., you're going to come up with less years B.C., not more. And likewise, the other number you gave. Let me just say this has been a very confusing passage for many people. Ezekiel was commanded to lie on his left side for a certain number of days, and also to lie on his right side a certain number of days, and these were said to be the days representing a year each that God would punish Israel and Judah, respectively. Israel would be punished for 390 years. Therefore, Ezekiel is to write, lay on his left side for 390 days to symbolize this. And then Judah would be punished for 40 years, and he was to lie on his right side for 40 days to symbolize that. Now, the very action of lying on his side for those days is very peculiar in itself. But, of course, much of what Ezekiel did was peculiar because he was supposed to get attention by, you know, I guess people wouldn't pay any attention to him if he didn't do things that were peculiar enough to arrest their attention as they went by. And so he is symbolically saying that God is going to punish Israel, the northern kingdom, 390 years, and then he's going to punish Judah, or he is also going to punish Judah, 40 years. Now, whether these periods, whether the shorter period falls within the longer period, we don't know, because the 40 years of Judah's punishment could fall within the 390 years of Israel's punishment, or could be added at the end, and no one really knows with certainty that the figures were round numbers rather than literal numbers. For example, if you want to measure from the division of the kingdom into the north and southern kingdoms, which was about 931 BC, if you measure to the end of the Babylonian captivity, which was 539 BC, the gap there from 931 BC to 539 BC would be 398 years. That's not exactly 390. It's 398. Comes close, but it's not exact. So the question would be, is that the time frame that Ezekiel's referring to and he's just estimating or using a round number? Possibly. The 40 years could be from 586 BC till 540. But since 40 is an important round number in Scripture, perhaps 47 years is simply rounded to 40. It's not really clear. It's really difficult to know. One thing that's rather interesting, I think, is that if you take the 390 years, which is the punishment of Israel, and the 40 years, which is the punishment of Judah, add that together, and you've got 430 years, which is the same length of time that the Jews were in exile in Babylon, I mean in Egypt previously, before Ezekiel's time, of course. And he may be saying, through symbolic numbers rather than literal numbers, that the punishment of Israel and Judah is going to be severe and comparable to the time that they spent in Egypt. Not necessarily saying it'll be really exactly the same length, but if of years they were in Egypt, and that might be simply a symbol. But simply being symbolic, connecting it with the captivity they've been in before. I don't know because it's not entirely clear when you start the count from. I have been having trouble with my equipment, as you can probably tell. My quality of my signal has degraded several times since the beginning of the program, and that's only been 15 minutes. I'm going to turn the equipment off and reboot it, and I'm going to ask my producer to play the music for a few minutes while I do that, and hopefully we will get a better signal for the rest of the program. If you'd like to call and be on the program today, we have lines open for you at 1-800-438-5090. Thank you. I apologize for the interruption. The problem is the equipment. We have been having problems this week with our equipment. If you've been listening to this program for years, you know that this kind of thing has happened from time to time. Some weeks we just have it cutting out on us. And for those of you who would wonder how that could be, I'm doing a remote broadcast every day. I'm in Santa Cruz. My flagship station is in Salinas, about 35, 40 miles away, and we're connected by a telephone line to each other. And when we have a good telephone connection, it's good and stable. Occasionally, we have a number of days in a row where the telephone connection is bad, and it keeps cutting out. And what our equipment does, first of all, it's connected at a high quality right now, but sometimes it just starts degrading, and it reduces the quality by increments. And I can see it happening on the display on the equipment, but I can't do anything about it. And if it gets really low, then I sound like I'm talking, you know, through a tin can. And then I have to just turn it off and reboot it. Now, hopefully that won't be happening very much, but that happens from time to time. And just this week we've had that happen, I think, a couple of different days, and we've had that problem today. So please bear with me. I can see that it's probably discouraging callers because we haven't had very many calls yet. If you'd like to call, we have our lines open at 1-800-438-5090. That's 1-800-438-5090. Another question that came to me in the email either today or yesterday is from Ryan in Eugene, Oregon, who says, "Steve, I have some questions about the lineage of Jesus. These are by no means salvation issues, but I'm curious to know what you think. Why do the genealogies of Jesus differ in Matthew chapter 1 and Luke chapter 3? And also a related question, I have heard that taught that Mary was a descendant of David. If this is true, why does the Bible show Joseph as a descendant of David? Thank you, Ryan." Well, Ryan, there are two genealogies of Jesus, and in my judgment, and that of many others, though it's not a unanimous opinion, the second genealogy, the one in chapter 3 of Luke, is actually Mary's genealogy. Now, it's not clearly hers, but it is apparently hers. Both genealogies on the surface look as if they might be Joseph's genealogy. And the one in Matthew clearly is. There's no question that the genealogy in Matthew chapter 1 is that of Joseph. The one in Luke 3 is more ambiguous. It's not clear whether it's Joseph's or Mary's. But I believe there's good reason to say it is Mary's. Now, both genealogies are related to David. David lived 1,000 years before Christ, and both of his parents descended from David by different lines from David. David had many children, and Mary's family came through one of David's children, and Joseph's family came through a different one of David's children. And so Jesus was related to David through both parents. Now, of course, Joseph was not his biological parent. Joseph was his legal parent, and therefore, whatever status Joseph had through his own personal genealogy would be imputed to Jesus as his legal son. And it so happens that Joseph was descended through the kingly line from David, through Solomon and Rehoboam and all the kings of Judah. And therefore, Joseph had a royal pedigree. And since Jesus was his legal, though not biological, son, Jesus also then had that legal standing as being of the royal pedigree through the kings of Judah. Now, his actual biological origins, however, were through Mary, and she also was descended from David through a different line, through a different one of David's sons. And how do we know that Luke is giving us Mary's genealogy? Well, not everyone agrees that she is, but I believe she is. And one of the ways we can tell that is that Luke, in the first two chapters of his book, give birth stories about Jesus, all related from the side of Mary. Her relatives, her family, her visit from the angel. Everything about the birth narratives in Luke comes from Mary's side. And therefore, Luke is obviously in touch with Mary's side of the issue, not Joseph's. And therefore, that he would give Mary's genealogy seems reasonable. Now, by the way, if you look at the birth narratives in Matthew, all the birth stories are related to Joseph. None of them are related directly to Mary. and Joseph's genealogy is given to Matthew. So it would appear that Luke and Matthew supplement each other. One of them gives Joseph's genealogy and tells the birth narratives from Joseph's side, that's Matthew, and Luke gives Mary's genealogy and tells the birth narratives from Mary's side. That's at least what I consider to be the likely conclusion from the data that's there, and I hope that may answer your question. We're going to talk now to Charles calling from San Jose, California. Charles, thanks for calling.
Yeah, hello?
Yeah, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, I was wondering how the races survived the Noah's flood.
Well, there's only one family that survived Noah's flood.
Okay.
And that was Noah's family. But all the races that are on Earth today, all the human lines, are descended from Noah's family. Just as whatever races may have existed before the flood were all descended from Adam and Eve's family. All races are really one race. There's not really races of human beings. We use the word race to speak of, you know, the black races and the Asian races and the white races and so forth. But really, there's only one race. There's only one human race, and they're all from one family. We're all brothers, or cousins at least, biologically, because we all came from the original couple, Adam and Eve, and more recently, we all came from Noah's family. So the fact that we are all of the same race explains how we could all have come from one set of parents. And so we are all descended from Noah's family. Now, Noah had three sons, and his sons had wives from whatever families we don't know. We don't know where his sons found wives. I mean, there were lots of women for them to choose from, but we just don't know the genealogies of their wives. And so, you know, there may have been some of the genetic variability to give rise to different races in either the sons of Noah or in their wives. But in any case, all the strains of the human family came from that one family after the flood.
Okay. I heard about this doctrine called the six-day man. Are you familiar with that?
The what?
The six-day man.
No, I have not heard it.
Are you allowed to mention other preachers on the air?
If you'd like.
This is from Shepherd's Chapel. They have a television ministry.
Okay, and, I'm not familiar with them.
Yeah, he's on Channel 26 at night, starting at 2 a.m. And their pastor is Pastor Arnold Murray, and he talks about a six-day creation, meaning most of the races were made on the sixth day, and the Adamic race, the race of Adam, was made on the eighth day.
The race of Adam was made on the eighth day?
Sometime after. But there was a six-day creation, because they were made on the sixth day. The race
Adam and Eve were made on the sixth day. Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, he says that there was a different, there's a difference between the day that Adam was made and that there were other people made on the sixth day.
Okay, well, he's not speaking according to the scriptures.
Okay, well, I just wanted to wonder, that's all I had.
Does he give some kind of scriptural support that he thinks teaches that?
Well, it's because they were mentioned in different chapters.
Well, yeah, Jesus is mentioned in several chapters of the Bible, but he's the same Jesus.
Oh, I don't know how he defends it.
This is what the Bible actually says. There's Adam is the father of all humanity. The Bible says that all of us were in Adam when he sinned. And Adam's sin affected the whole human race because we all descended from Adam, the Bible teaches us. And Eve, the reason she's called Eve, which is in Hebrew Chava, which means life or living, is because it says she's the mother of all living. Okay, so the Bible specifically says that all humans came out of Adam and that Eve was the mother of all living. So we read of Adam by name in Genesis chapter 2 and Eve by name in chapter 2. It's true that in the previous chapter, on the sixth day, we read that God made man and woman, and it doesn't mention their names there. in, must be around verse 27. I'm not looking at it, but Genesis 1, I think 27 or so, it mentions that God made male and female. He made man and woman. But it doesn't mention their names in chapter 1. But then the story is more detail is given to the story in chapter 2, and we are told their names, Adam and Eve. And it's specifically and clearly stated that all the human family descended from those two. So the male and female they made on the sixth day must have been them.
Well, I don't know what's the reasoning he has behind that. I just know that's what I thought I heard on his ministry.
You know, some preachers, I don't know this gentleman, but some preachers and teachers and individual Christians, when they read the Bible, they don't understand it, and they just come up with some kind of a original idea of their own, and then they have the boldness to preach it as if it's, you know, gospel. I mean, it's one thing to read the Bible and have an idea of your own about it. I mean, sometimes because we don't know everything, we do try to fill in the gaps of our knowledge with theories that come to our minds. But if somebody comes up with a theory like that, he certainly has no business teaching it as doctrine on television, certainly not unless it's a widespread and provable biblical doctrine. And I don't think this guy has very much understanding of the early chapters of Genesis.
I don't know. He's actually a doctor.
Doctor what? I mean, a doctor of a medical doctor, or he's a PhD?
I don't know.
If he's a PhD, that might mean post-hole digger. You know, I'll tell you something. You can go through, first of all, you can become a doctor through the internet. If you just send money, you send money to the right people on the internet, they'll send you a doctorate. And there are people preaching today who got their doctorates without ever studying anything. If he graduated from a college, that still doesn't mean he ever learned how to think. He might have. I'm not trying to put the man down. I'm just saying that the fact that a man has a PhD after his name or doctor before his name doesn't mean that he knows anything about reasoning or thinking or exegesis. It just means that he learned how to jump through the hoops of an academic institution and get himself a degree. How do I know this? Well, I know this because I'm continually reading books by people who have PhD behind their names, and I'm often amazed at how incapable they seem to be of reasoning in simple logic. And so I guess what I'm saying is, while there are very intelligent people who do possess and who don't possess PhDs, the presence of PhD behind them doesn't really tell you whether the man knows how to think, certainly doesn't tell us whether he knows how to read and study the Bible.
I just wanted to get your ideas on there.
Okay, Charles, I appreciate it.
Okay, thank you.
God bless you. Bye-bye. All right, our next caller today is Seth calling from Hillsboro, Oregon. Hi, Seth. How you doing?
Hey, Steve. Good to talk to you again.
Yeah, good to hear from you.
So I got a question for you. I'm doing a Bible read-through with some friends this year, and right now we're in the books of Kings. And throughout the book, in the assessment of the various kings, there's kind of grades of good and bad. And some of the good kings, it says that they did everything right, except they didn't take down the high places. And this was the question that we were talking about the other day, a group. And I guess my question for you is, what was so bad about the sacrifices that went on at the high places?
Well, the high places were groves of trees where the Canaanites had originally worshipped their deities before the time that Joshua conquered the land of Canaan. The Canaanites who were there before performed our idolatrous worship in these groves, on these hilltops and so forth, these high places. And so when Joshua and the people of Israel conquered those peoples, they didn't kill them all. And so later generations after Joshua, some of them defected from the worship of Yahweh, and they began to worship the deities on the high places. Sometimes they even tried to worship Yahweh on the high places, although he had forbidden that, essentially. But the main objectionable thing about the high places is that people typically worshipped idols there. Now, it's possible that during the reigns of some of the better kings, that people didn't worship idols at the high places, and they may have even worshipped Yahweh there against his instructions. But that being the case, if they did that, they're not exactly doing it where they're supposed to, and that's an offense. That's a black mark against them. But it may not be as bad as worshiping idols there would be. And in the reigns of the better kings, they usually tried to abolish idolatry during their reign. In fact, that's what made them better kings. You know, all the kings had something bad about them. Hezekiah, Josiah, you know, these were very good kings. But each one of them, there's something bad they did, at least near the end of their reign. And, you know, there was no king that was completely good, just because there's no humans that are perfect. But a man was considered to be a good king if in his reign he discouraged or abolished idol worship. And a king who sponsored idol worship was an evil king. But you know, almost all other mistakes that a man made, almost all other sins that he committed, are not counted against him if he didn't worship idols. Like even David. David's considered a good king, but he committed some terrible sins. But he never worshipped idols. And it's sort of like the assessment of a wife. I had a wife when I was young who committed adultery. I'd say she was a very bad wife, you know. I had another wife later on who never committed adultery. She was not easy to live with and so forth, and perhaps I was not either. But the point is, whatever defects she may have had, she was still my wife. I still consider her a good wife as long as she was faithful to me. I mean, she and I might both have defects in our conduct, but as long as we were faithful to each other, we were still married. And when Israel did not worship idols, they were still in covenant with God. But when they worshiped idols, it was adultery they were committing against God. And so the kings that sponsored idolatry were always referred to as wicked. And often it says that they continued in the ways of the sin of Jeroboam, who set up idols in the northern kingdom. But a good king, often they do some bad things, but they're good anyway, so long as they did not sponsor idolatry.
So did it become a worse thing after the establishment of the temple? Because I seem to remember that in the time of Samuel, he actually did do sacrifices on the high places, but it was to Yahweh.
That's right. Yeah, the temple, the building of the temple in Jerusalem seems to be the point in time when it became intolerable to offer sacrifices elsewhere. Because you're right, in the days of Samuel, when the temple was at Shiloh, actually a lot of the time in Samuel's day, the tabernacle didn't even exist. You know, when Samuel was a little boy, the tabernacle was destroyed and the ark was captured by the Philistines.
Right.
And it would appear that the tabernacle was kind of non-existent for some generations there. And I think that would explain why Samuel and some others would worship on the high places or in some other prominent location, because the tabernacle was no longer there.
Okay. Well, that about does it for me then.
Okay, Seth. Good talk to you.
All right. You too. Thanks.
Thanks for your call. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Okay, we're going to talk next to John, calling from Portland, Oregon. Hi, John. Welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. First of all, I'd like to say I appreciate your ministry. By now, I think you may be able to tell that because I do listen in a lot. Anyway, you might find that hard to believe, but the thing is, you know, I think what we have is we do disagree a lot. I admit that I believe there's a lot of prophecy that still needs to be fulfilled, and you being a partial preterist don't believe that. But anyway, I have, last time we talked, you wanted me to organize something in a format that would be good for the radio. But I have another question. So I could do that, or what I could do is I have another question about when the apocalypse is written.
Okay, whichever you want. Whichever you want. Just, I mean, we have limits on our time because there's other calls waiting.
Right.
Just choose one of those two and do it.
All right, well, I think I'm a little more prepared to do the one on the apocalypse. It says, according to the Antonicene Fathers, St. John of the Apostle was banished to Patmos at A.D. 96 when he wrote the fourth gospel in the apocalypse. So then what is the argument of the preterist that the book of Revelation was written before 80s.
Okay. Well, the Antonicene Fathers, who said that John was banished to Patmos during the reign of Domitian in probably the 90s AD, almost certainly are all basing their viewpoint on a statement made by Irenaeus around 170 or 180 AD. Irenaeus said that it was near the end of the reign of Nero, end of Domitian. And the statement by Irenaeus, most scholars, I think, would say, provided the basis for later fathers to repeat that information. Now, whether Irenaeus was right or not, or even what he meant, has been debated.
For example... What did Irenaeus say?
What Irenaeus said, he was discussing the mark of the beast, and while I can't quote him verbatim, his statement went something like this. You know, he says, I will not venture to pronounce upon the identity of the beast, whose number is 666. He says, for if it had been his intention to let us know the identity, John himself could have told us, the one who wrote the heavenly vision, which was seen, he says, not very long ago, almost in our own day, even near the end of Domitian's reign. Now, it sounds like it's saying that either John or the vision was seen near the end of Domitian's reign, which would put it around 96 AD, if that's the case. But what some scholars have debated is whether Irenaeus is saying that John saw the vision near the end of Domitian's reign, or that John himself was last seen near the end of Domitian's reign. You know, and his vision might have been, seen sometime prior to that, but he himself lived up until the end of Domitian's reign. And so it's not 100% clear what Irenaeus is saying, but it certainly does sound, just upon a casual reading, it sounds like he's saying that John saw that vision near the end of Domitian's reign. And Irenaeus was an early father. As I say, he wrote about 170 or 180 AD. And a lot of the later church fathers followed Irenaeus in this declaration. And it may be true. However, it's not certainly true, and there are evidences to the contrary. Right within the book of Revelation, there are some evidences that point to an earlier date during the reign of Nero. Now, Nero reigned from, I think he came to power in 62 AD. He began persecuting the church in 64 or 65, and he committed suicide in 68 AD. So the entire reign of Nero was prior to 70 AD. And if John wrote during the reign of Nero, then of course Revelation was written before 70 AD and might be predicting that event. Now, what evidences are there for it being written earlier? A number of evidences are pointed to. One is that in chapter 11 of Revelation, the first two verses have John measuring the temple, the inner part of the temple, not the outer court, because the outer court was going to be given to the Gentiles for a period of time. Now, that measurement of the temple seems to be symbolic of God preserving the measured part of the temple, but giving the rest of it over to the Gentiles to trample underfoot. This vision seems to suggest that the temple was then standing. That is, it was a prediction of its preservation, or at least the preservation of part of it, and the giving over of part of it to be trampled by the Gentiles. And so, at least many scholars have felt that the presence of that vision is implying that the temple was standing at the time that John saw the vision. And if so, then of course, since the temple was destroyed in AD 70, this would have to be prior to that. Then you have the number of the beast, of course, 666. Obviously, numbers and letters and names can be manipulated many different ways to make them add up to 666. And I've seen many different theories as to whose name that's referring to, but one of the theories is it's referring to Caesar Nero, because Caesar Nero, if you give his name in Hebrew characters, it comes out to 666. And so some say that that's a reference to Nero there. Then there's also the statement in Revelation 17 that there are seven kings, and it says five are fallen, one now is, and the other, another's yet to come. Now, in saying that five kings have fallen, and the sixth king now is, meaning when John wrote that, the sixth king was then in power. Many have understood that to mean that the kings represent emperors, and that five emperors had died, and the sixth emperor of the Roman Empire was currently reigning when John wrote that, and Nero was the sixth emperor. Now, all of these passages, I believe, can be interpreted differently, so that they don't prove the early date. I think they help support the early date thesis. But to me, the most important argument for the earlier date is that there are many visions in the book of Revelation which correspond with other passages of the Bible, which the other passages are talking about the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD. There are passages in Daniel, there's passages in the Olivet Discourse, there's passages in Zechariah, there's passages in various other books of the Bible that are predicting, as I understand it, they're predicting the destruction of Jerusalem in 70 AD, and these passages find echo or recurrence in the book of Revelation, which seems to make it likely that it points to that also. Now, besides all that, there is the fact that about five times in the book of Revelation, John tells his readers that the things that he's predicting are going to soon take place and that the time is at hand. In fact, in one place, in chapter 22, verse 10, he actually says, "The angel said to me, do not seal up the visions of this book, the words of this book, because the time is at hand." And that statement is particularly telling, I think, because in Daniel chapter 12, Daniel asked for more information about the visions he was seeing, and the angel told him, "Go your way, Daniel. It's sealed up." He said, "Seal it up for the time of the end." Now, what he means by that is that Daniel's prophecies were not going to be immediately fulfilled in Daniel's time. Therefore, they were to be sealed up until a later time, to be consulted by a later generation. But John is told, don't seal up the prophecy of the book of Revelation because the time is at hand. So, unlike Daniel, who was specifically told that the prophecies would not be fulfilled immediately in his time, he should seal the book up, John was told the prophecies were going to be fulfilled immediately, and he should therefore not seal the book. That's Revelation 22:10. So what I'm saying is there's many indicators in the book of Revelation that the things that are written there would soon take place after the time that they were prophesied. In fact, in chapter 1, verse 19, John is told to write the things you have seen, the things which are, and the things which are about to take place. That's how verse 19 of chapter 1 reads in the Greek. The things that are about to take place. So here John is writing to some actual people, some actual churches, seven churches that existed in Asia Minor in his own day. And he writes them an epistle, just like Paul wrote epistles to people living in his day. So John wrote this as an epistle to seven churches in Asia, including his home church of Ephesus. And he tells them, these things are about to take place. These things, the time is at hand. These are about to happen. The time is near. Now, unless the time really was near when he said that, these statements would be extremely misleading to his readers. But I don't think he was being misleading. I think he told the truth. I think the things he predicted were indeed at hand and it were fulfilled shortly afterwards. However, if this was written during the reign of Domitian, there's actually no event that happened within any number of generations after that that could correspond with the predictions of Revelation. But if he wrote it during the reign of Nero, as I think is more likely, then the events of the destruction of Jerusalem and the Jewish war would easily fit that. As I pointed out, there's lots of other passages that in the Bible that Revelation alludes to in Ezekiel and Daniel and Zechariah and the Olivet Discourse and so forth that are referring to 70 AD, and he's echoing them, because I think that the prophecy there is about that.
Okay, so then what do we do with the Internecine Fathers telling us that it was during Domitian's rule that
Well, as I said, Irenaeus seems to be the one who originated that piece of historical information. Irenaeus also said that Jesus lived to be about 50 years old. Now, most Bible scholars don't believe that that's true. They don't believe that Jesus lived to be 50. Most would say he died in his early 30s. And so Irenaeus, you know, he has his opinions. He gives his own statements of what he thinks. But I'm not a student of Irenaeus primarily. I'm a student of the Bible, and I believe the Bible has much more authority than Irenaeus. So looking at this information inside Revelation, its own statements, and comparing with other scripture, that's where I reached the conclusion that it was written before 70 AD. The evidence for it written later than that is all external evidence and mostly comes from Irenaeus and those who followed him. Well, he might have been right, but where you've got internal evidence pointing one direction and external evidence pointing a different direction, I would go with the internal evidence because the internal evidence is in the Bible and the external evidence is not. External evidence is external to the Bible and it's from man. And no matter how wonderful or early the man lived, he's still fallible, more than the Bible is, I think. So I would support the Bible against Irenaeus if there's a contradiction between the two men, between John and Irenaeus. Now, of course, there are people who think there's internal evidence for a late date, but I've looked at their evidence and there's nothing very compelling about it. Actually, if you have access to the web and can go to our Bible forum, I've written extensively in response to dispensationalists who have argued for a later date, and I've answered them most of their arguments. So, anyway, actually I do that in my book too. Have you ever seen my book, Revelation Four Views, a Parallel Commentary?
I have seen it.
Okay, in the introduction, there's an extensive treatment of the arguments for the early date and for the late date. I give the full quotation from Irenaeus, and I describe what the problems are that make it ambiguous.
Okay. Well, can I have a couple minutes to read what the Antinousian father said?
Which father are you going to read from?
Hippolytus and... Well, there's a general one from Rosemary Ellen Gailey in the Encyclopedia of the Saints.
Okay, well, she's not one of the fathers, but I'll tell you what. We can simply, rather than take that time, because there's only about 4 minutes left, and I have another call to take, I'd rather just say those fathers did say that it was written in the reign of Domitian. So we don't need to read them saying it. We'll just acknowledge that they said that.
Okay. Thanks for your thanks, and I'll call again.
Okay, John, thanks.
Oh, bye.
Bye now. Okay, Tom from Aurora, Oregon. Thanks for waiting so long. You'll be our last caller today. Welcome to the Narrow Path.
Thanks, Steve. How you doing?
Fine. Thank you.
Hey, yeah, I got questions. Your last call was kind of along the same lines, but not really. But my question is about Matthew 24.
Uh-huh.
And where it talks, you know, it talks about there will be false Christ, and it goes on, and it talks about kingdom rising against kingdom and nation against nation.
Yeah.
It continues on, and it says, when you see the abomination of desolation spoken through the prophet Daniel,
mm-hmm.
you know, then you should run to the hills and all of that. And then it keeps on going. And in verse 29, I mean, it keeps going, and, you know, it lists all these things that are going to happen, this great tribulation, or a tribulation anyway. And then
yeah.
In 29 it says, but immediately after the tribulation of those days, the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light and the stars will fall from the sky and the powers of heaven will be shaken. And then the sign of the Son of Man will appear in the sky and then the tribes of the earth will mourn. And it goes on and it says, and he will send forth his angels with a great trumpet and they will gather together his elect from the four winds from one end of the sky to the other. And my question is, I've never been able to reconcile this passage of scripture with the pre-trib rapture that I've always been taught for 20 years in the church. And every time I've ever asked anybody about it, I kind of get this, you just need to believe this kind of a answer, because if you don't, you're really not much of a Christian. You know what I mean? And
you can certainly be a good Christian without believing the pre-trib rapture, because all Christians didn't believe it until 1830. There weren't any Christians who believed it.
Mm-hmm. So,
Question
is, this verse 29 where it says about the sun will be darkened and the moon, has that ever happened?
This is the language of prophecy. The moon being darkened, the sun being darkened, the moon turned to blood. These are images that you'll find in the Old Testament prophets when they describe the downfall of a great nation like Babylon.
Mm-hmm.
In Isaiah 13:10, when Babylon fell, the prophecy about it said that the sun will be darkened and the moon will not give its light and the stars will be darkened and so forth. In Isaiah, I think it's chapter 32 or 34, it might be 34, it talks about the destruction of Edom or the judgment that came on Edom. And these are years before Jesus came that this actually was fulfilled. It says that the heavens will be rolled up like a scroll, the stars will fall like figs from a fig tree. The destruction of Egypt by Babylon was predicted in Ezekiel 32, and it says the sun and the moon and the stars will be made dark and so forth. Now, this is just poetic language that
okay.
the prophets used. When a great kingdom was falling, sometimes the prophets speak of it as if the lights are going out for them. They're not going to see the light of the sun is dark and the moon doesn't give us light. In the sense that this is how they perceive it. Their lights are going out. They're dying. They're becoming extinct. But in this particular case, the sun being darkened and the moon turning to blood is referred to in Joel chapter 2 and quoted in Acts chapter 2 as fulfilled. Peter said this is that which Joel spoke about. He talks about the sun
right.
shall be darkened and the moon shall turn to blood. And this apparently is referring to the darkening of the sky with the great smoke that came up from the burning of the city.
Mm-hmm.
Because it says there will be blood and fire and pillars of smoke. The sun will be darkened and the moon will look blood red. If you've ever lived in L.A., I have. I grew up down there. When there's a lot of smog, sometimes the moon looks red, blood red even. I've seen it look blood red many times because of smog. The smoke can do that.
Right.
So there's some, in some sense, this could be almost literal.
Mm-hmm.
If we're talking about the darkening of the sky with the smoke from the burning city.
Right.
But it's also the kind of language the prophets used non-literally when they spoke about the downfall of the kingdom. So it could go either way. Mm-hmm. Now, when it talks about the sign of the Son of Man will appear in heaven, it doesn't say the Son of Man will appear. It says the sign of the Son of Man will appear
mm-hmm.
in heaven. And there are signs that happened in 70 A.D. and thereabouts in the heavens that Josephus records that seem to be, Josephus says that at one point during the war, above Jerusalem, people could look up in the clouds and they saw soldiers in armor running in the clouds. Now, I didn't make this up. Josephus told us that. And he said, there are signs that appeared. He said there was a star like the shape of a sword that hung over Jerusalem for a full year in the sky. And so you've got these different signs that Josephus records happened. And as far as the angels being sent to gather the elect, the word angels means messengers in the Greek. It sometimes means heavenly messengers, sometimes earthly, but I believe this is referring to the fact that the God's messengers were sent out to the four corners of the earth to gather the elect into the church. That is through evangelism.
Mm-hmm.
It's not necessarily talking about gathering them into the sky.
Cool.
If these things are indeed talking about the end of the world, then that's fine. But all the language in this passage could be applied to what happened in 70 A.D., so it makes it difficult to insist on a future fulfillment.
Cool. Well, thanks.
Tom, I got to go, I'm afraid. My music's playing, but I appreciate your call.
Yeah, I appreciate you answering it. That sheds a whole lot of light on it for me. Thank you.
All right. God bless you.
God bless.
Thanks. You've been listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg. We do this Monday through Friday for an hour from 2 to 3 in the afternoon. We pay the radio bills because, I would say because God provides. And the way He provides is not through sponsors because we don't sell anything or sell any advertising. We don't have any advertising breaks. Our website doesn't sell anything. We just trust the Lord for our provision to pay the radio bills, which are many thousands of dollars a month. Well, we've been doing it for 10 years because I believe the Lord has been supplying. If you want to help us pay those bills, you can. Write to us at the Narrow Path, P.O. Box 3633, Santa Cruz, California. 95063. Our website is www.thenarrowpath.com. Till tomorrow, this is Steve Gregg saying thanks for joining us. Tune in again tomorrow. We'll continue our discussion. God bless.